get everybody's attention.
Good morning. Hello, hello. How's everybody? The fact that you're here is a good sign. That means you've done two important things. You switched your clocks ahead this morning, and you made it here on time. Either that, or you just wandered into the wrong panel, and you also made it through a Saturday night in Austin. Both are quite accomplishments. So we appreciate you coming. My name is John Purdy. I'm with Red Knight Learning Systems. I'm president. And we're going to be talking this morning with my fellow panelists about serious games. And the topic is going to be focused mostly on this idea of, can learning be hard fun? And we'll get into a little bit more in a minute about what that is. With me today on the panel, I've got Lauren Davis from Hidden Agenda Games, Paul Medcalf from BlockDot, and Mindy Jackson from Inspire Learning. And I'll let each of them introduce themselves a little bit more when we get into the content here in just a second. But let's start out by asking a little bit about you. How many people out there are developers, in either interactive or serious game developers? How many of you are educators? We qualify that way. How about press? Okay. And how about designers? Anybody a designer? Any other major category I didn't cover? Oh, what's that? Investors. Okay, we'll talk afterwards. Okay. And how familiar are you with serious games? How many of you have barely heard it? You saw the title and/or you just walked into the wrong place. You just know a little bit about it. How many of you know serious games extremely well, have developed them, are very familiar with them, been doing it for a while? Okay, we got a couple in the audience. And how many of the rest of you are in the middle there, kind of sort of know about them a little bit, want to know more? Good. Okay, that helps. Well, let me tell you where this, talk a little bit about this idea of hard fun and where the title came from, at least, and what we're going to try to do with our discussion today. The book, Engaging Learning by Clark Quinn, is one that gave me the idea for this panel, and as I roped in these folks to be on the panel with me, I talked to them a little bit about what I got out of this book. And the idea of hard fun, Clark Quinn did not, you know, create this term, but he picked it up from somewhere else, but he uses it in his book, and it's the idea of pushing yourself, whether you're doing it in learning or whether you're doing it in some engaging activity, could be an engaging entertainment activity, where you kind of get to that point where you're challenged, and maybe you fail even, but you're challenged enough where you want to go back and try it again, and as you do, you learn something, and you get to that point where you're having fun. It's the idea that, you know, if you push yourself, if you think about it, there have been, you probably had, most of us had, a professor in college who was hard, but they actually made the class really enjoyable and fun and really pushed you to go beyond your current abilities. So we're going to try to roll that into the idea of, can we use video games for that purpose? Can they be done in a way that makes learning hard fun? So what are serious games? you'll hear a variety of definitions, and there's a number of ways to define it. On the really narrow side, is they're just about learning games, educational games. And I admit that in my business, in our company, because we're a serious games developer, I tend to use it more in that term than any other. But it also can be defined as games with non-entertainment purposes. So that's another good way to look at it. That is, anything, any kind of game that's not really meant just for entertainment could be considered a serious game, right? And again, our panelists will probably toss in a couple of other views as well. Well, another way to try to define serious games is look at the genres, and this is not a comprehensive list, but as you can see here, this is a list that a lot of people would agree can be used for defining serious games. And again, our panelists will talk a little bit more about some of these, and we'll give some examples as we go along. So we're going to start with a few examples. That's one of the best ways to kind of define what we're talking about and then get into our topic. And you'll look at this quote here from Peter Rod, who's the director of the Guild Hall, which is a school that teaches gaming at SMU in Dallas. And if a picture is worth 1,000 words, animation is worth 1,000 pictures, and a game is worth 1,000 animations. And for those of you who don't want to do the math, that means a game's worth 1,000,000,000 pictures. So, okay, so we're going to break out here, and each of our panelists is going to come up and tell you a little brief moment about themselves and then show you some examples or talk about some examples of serious games. Yeah. And pardon us while we do a little switcheroo here.
Speaking to that one. Hi, I'm Lauren Davis, and I'm with a small family nonprofit foundation called the Lemont Foundation that's based here in Austin, Texas. And the Lemont Foundation, the Lemont family, asked me back in 2003 to help them make a difference in the educational game space for middle school students. That's what they wanted to focus their foundation on. And they gave me a whole $25,000 to build a video game. And so I think some of you gamers out there know that's, you know, maybe about one-tenth of what a potentially decent game might cost to get developed. So I had to get creative on how to develop those games. And so I turned to the cheapest labor that I know about that is also really creative and intelligent, and that's college students. So I created an educational game development contest for college students to build games for middle school students that were really fun but secretly taught these middle school students a school subject. So I created that contest back in 2003. It's been running strong since then. And through the Hidden Agenda contest, we've gotten some great games built by students and then initially developed by students but kind of finished out by professional developers. And we created the Hidden Agenda game site, or hagames.com. And that's what you see over there. It's right now we have 4 games available that teach middle school math, science, things like that. And they're all free for middle school students, teachers, parents, anyone who wants to use them. And we're in the process of distributing them right now. So I think the rest of these guys are going to show you actual video games. They're going to play around a little bit. I'm just going to show you examples of 4 of the games on the Hidden Agenda game site, hagames.com. And you can go there yourself and play them whenever you get a chance. So this is the site. The 4 games we have up here. Mech'em is a game that was the winner the first year of the contest. It is a robot battle game that middle school kids love to play against each other. What they have to do is they have to build their own robots made out of real materials. So they're learning physics and chemistry properties and building their robots, and then they fight them against each other. So, for example, if somebody builds a robot out of diamond armor, they're really excited when a laser shooter tries to shoot it because the index of reflection, you know, shoots the laser off the robot. But if somebody uses a shock weapon, then, you know, the diamond doesn't absorb any of that energy and then the head blows off of the robot. So they're actually learning chemistry and physics in a lot of different ways with Mech'em. This game here, Elemental, is a favorite of a lot of people. It's I think it's personally my favorite because I'm kind of a chemistry geek at heart. It's a periodic table Tetris-like game. So picture blocks falling from the sky, but instead of having to make shapes in order to make the blocks go away, you actually have to form compounds. And then Waste of Space here was the winner of the most recent Hidden Agenda contest. And that's kind of an asteroids-like game where you are a space garbage man and you're trying to collect all your trash and shoot the bad guys, but you're using real physics properties, so you're learning velocity and acceleration and thrust and things like that as you're steering your garbage space truck. And then the last one is Algebra Arcade. This one's still in process, but it's kind of a Pac-Man game, but it teaches the this will bring you back, the FOIL method of algebra, the first, outer, inner, last method of solving algebra equations. It's a theory that's pretty hard for middle school kids to grasp, because it's something that they just need to practice a million times before they get better at it. But with this game, it kind of, they're practicing and they don't quite realize they're practicing. But you should definitely play the games to see what I mean. So those are four games. I encourage you to try them out on your own. And I think I'm going to pass it back to John.
Thank you, Lauren. We'll have Paul Medcalf of Block Duck Games up now.
Hi, my name's Paul Medcalf. I work at Block Duck Games as a game programmer and gameplay designer. And in a past life, I worked with John working on some Cisco games. Some games that we created for Cisco systems to teach about different topics. So what I want to go over was a game that we created for to teach about wireless networking. And one of the topics that we wanted to discuss on this, and there might be a sound here, so let me pause. We had several different objectives that we wanted to talk about, or we wanted to teach. We wanted to talk about the different types of components of a wireless network, you know, like your access points, your bridges, your repeaters. There's also different antennas, directional antennas, omnidirectional antennas, Yagi antennas as well. And then there's also the security types of wireless networks, whether it's an open network or you know, or the different security protocols. So we created this game, and we, you know, most of the Cisco games, we want to make it a little bit more fun. We introduce a different environment that is not typical. To kind of help engage the player a little bit more and get a little bit more involvement from them. So we set this one in space, and what we did on this game was create a level-based, a puzzle-type of game where you have different rooms and you have different requirements, wireless network requirements, that you need to figure out based on the hardware that you're provided how to cover everybody that's in those rooms. So I think we have about 12 levels in this. I've kind of modified this version to kind of skip to the next ones. But one of the things that we did in the design of each one of these levels is we gradually introduce new topics, new concepts. So we don't bombard everybody at the same time with all this information. So right now we're in a level and we just have access points. We've already kind of talked about what these are your network drops, and you need an access point to be installed on a network drop. Here's an omnidirectional antenna. This is a directional antenna. We kind of talk people through. You can actually adjust this you know, and point, so you get a wider range with an omnidirectional as opposed to a omnidirectional. Or did I say the same thing twice? I don't remember. And so I've played this, so I know exactly where all my access points should go. A Yagi antenna I thought was very interesting, and that's, ignore that. That didn't happen. okay. And, so on a Yagi, and I thought this was really fun, Yagi antenna is kind of like a directional antenna, except you can focus the beam further, or, you know, more, and shoot it out so it actually reaches a little bit further. So one of the challenges to this game and each one of these levels was to kind of make it in a way that it was fun. It kind of got people that once they figured out exactly how the puzzle worked, or, you know, it was an interesting balance between covering everything that we needed to cover and actually designing the levels in a way that they were fun, they were challenging, but there was a solution, but it wasn't necessarily completely in your face solution. And it was more kind of driven for entertainment in that aspect and the level designs. But what you were actually working with was the educational part, you know, the different antennas, what the spreads are. And it's still one of my favorite games that we've created. This one talks about bridges. These are dead. These don't have an internet connection. There's only one drop in this level. So, you know, on a bridge, you have to set up two bridges or two endpoints and then point them at each other. And then that activates this entire extra network that before did not have any network connectivity. So even through that, you know, one of the things that was kind of interesting working with the subject matter experts is after we designed the game, we've got to create the game and modify it to actually work the way that bridges work, which was kind of interesting. Am I kind of getting over my time?
Yeah.
Okay. All right.
You're close.
So, but yeah, that's the what I wanted to cover, actually.
Okay. Thank you, Paul. Yeah. So next we'll have Mindy from Inspire. Let me get out of this part for you.
Hi, I'm Mindy Jackson. And I'm the Director of Instructional Design at Inspire Learning. We're a small development company here in Austin, right next door to the Dog and Duck Pub on 17th and Guadalupe for the locals. And for the not locals, that's a great place to hang out. And what we do is we create games, simulations, and other types of interactive learning experiences, mainly for corporations, some nonprofits. We've done some K-12 and actually some university-based instruction, too. Harvard Business School is one of our larger clients, for example. So thank you for pulling this up.
Sure.
Here. So I don't know about the rest of you, but I woke up really early this morning. It was really early. And I'm not just talking about the time change. I mean, I really woke up about 3 o'clock, but it was really 4 o'clock. But the worry that I had was... I worried about what I was going to present to you today at the panel because I thought, I don't think I'm really required to make a proof point that good games equals good learning. Who here doesn't believe that good games can create good learning experiences? Does anybody believe that? So I've already got you all convinced. Or I don't have you convinced. You're already convinced. The medium itself is convincing enough. So I think what we're seeing in the marketplace and what might differentiate good games for learning, or that's to say, what is good game design versus what is good instructional design, or let's just say, what is a good game experience and what's the normal learning experience that we have. As an instructional designer, I often look at the tell me, show me, let me model of instruction and understanding how to interweave those elements. Games are really good about doing a little bit of telling, a little bit more showing, and a lot of letting. Now, all of you can remember from your school experiences that most of it is telling, a little bit of showing, and not near as much doing, letting, as we would like. So I'm going to show some examples from Inspire Learning. Up here is a count challenge. I don't know how well y'all can see that. This is kind of the lighting.
Click on that.
Whoops.
Click on that.
Double click this. Oh, there we go. Thank you. So account challenge, this is an, I brought in 3 samples, and I'll try to be very quick, but samples of corporate, corporate-based training that I think incorporated some good examples of this interplay between what we know as good game design with what we know is good instructional design. And in this particular example, the account challenge sales simulation, it's a bit of a role-play game. And the game mechanics really follow the natural order of a sales progression. You start out with account qualification and prospecting, and you go in and you do some sales solutioning. You have to create a proposal. You have to handle objections to the sale. You have to negotiate and close the deal. Well, what you're seeing here is a screen right up at the beginning of the course where you've made entry here into Satsuma Computer, where you're going to be selling to the data center, actually. And you have Janice Carrington. Well, depending upon how well you negotiate with Janice Carrington, you will unlock potential important information and potential other allies and introductions to other people, maybe higher up in the corporate food chain than Janice, who's director of invoicing. So along the way, you uncover information, you unlock resources, and then you use those resources to build your proposal and ultimately to construct your sales points and negotiate the deal. And as you can see up here, there's also a consultant mentor. So you're not in here all by yourself. So that was one example I wanted to show you. I'll do this one. This is fun. This is actually a trailer for a course we did for SAP.
When your project team spans different parts of the globe, communication is a challenge. Time is a challenge. Culture is a challenge. But every challenge has a champion. And every champion has a mentor. SAP University presents Training unlike anything you've ever seen. Tackling the toughest virtual team management issues from planning, meetings, communicating, trust, managing performance, and culture. From what can go right to what can go wrong. With interactive business simulations, real-world scenarios, engrossing fun stories. Get ready for Virtual Team Management. Training has never been quite like this. Available now at the SAP Library.
Oh, I didn't hear any laughing from team managers out there. Isn't that what you're...
Still early.
What I'll just say about that briefly is why I like that example is that it was for SAP, the German software company, and not only did they want to improve their virtual team management skills because they have people just all over the world cooperating in their projects, but they wanted to build in some cultural sensitivity and understanding of differences. And so rather than create our own cultural stereotypes that you know, might afford the type of sensitivity and thinking about how we are different and how we accommodate differences, we created this other world called Orth. It's not Earth, it's Orth. But there's these other people in these cultures, and they're doing a lot of the same things that we're doing, and they have to get along, and you have to get along with them, and you have to integrate on their team. There's a resource allocation game within it as well. There's a lot of role play. It's kind of an imaginative, embodied narrative experience that you find in a lot of games that is both engaging and entertaining. And then my last example real quickly is executive challenge. I'll just show you, this is one of the screens of the Executive Challenge Project, which is a leadership development game. But it's delivered in a blended environment where, along with this game, there's a moderator and there's other offline activities that are facilitated. Now, here's some people doing some rounds. The gameplay happens in quarters and rounds. The idea is that the game itself is but an instructional tool, an instrument. The learning isn't really happening in the game. The learning is happening outside the game. The game sets context. The game sets the shared experience. The game is what gets people all on the same page together talking about the same thing versus maybe traditional role play where you might come in and say, okay, now imagine, you know, you're the VP of sales and I'm the VP of supplies and we've got some issues. And there's a lot of burden on your imagination to say, okay, I can play along. What, you know, okay, so what's the situation? What's the scenario? What's my role? What's my problem? We set up all of the situational issues, all the contextual issues, and then the learners engage in those problems, and they're strategizing, they're debriefing, they're communicating, they're getting coaching, and that is what's really effective about this game environment. So okay. I'll leave it at that.
Great. Thank you very much. I'm going to show one more example. I move over here. I think I mentioned earlier that I'm president of a company called Red Knight Learning Systems, and we develop serious games and simulations. However, this is not developed by us. And what I'm going to show you, though, I'm showing you this game because it's one that's gotten a lot of press, and I think it's a very good example of what's been out in the what's out in the market now as a kind of a higher end serious game, and it's in particular in the area of called. It's in the area called Games for Health, and we get past the intro screens here. This will take about 5 minutes to show you this, but I think it's worth it. This game, Remission, was developed for teenagers who had cancer, and the idea is to let them use the game to learn about more about cancer and about their treatments, about chemotherapy and radiation, and the importance of, you know, staying with their medicines and so forth. And it's also meant to just help them try to improve their health. We're going to be picking a character here called Roxy, and I'm just going to show you part of the tutorials. And this is actually a first-person shooter type game. And Roxy is our, you'll see, is our character here. She's guided through her training by a little bot character. And they get you, you know, like any game, it gets you started by learning how to move and then how to use the weapons and then what your goals of the game are. In this case, your goals are to use your weapons to your chemotherapy and so forth to actually to fight bacteria and so forth. So we'll watch and listen, and I'll play a little bit of it here in a second.
Smitty, where are you? I'm ready to shoot things.
You better be. Your primary purpose is to combat cancer and cancer-related illness. If you prove successful in these trials, you will be injected into patients to monitor a patient's health, eliminate cancer cells, and fight infections.
That's a tall order. As in, I'm so small. I'm microscopic. So how do I fit in?
Your size, programming, and weapons make you a tiny force to be reckoned with against individual cancer cells and bacteria.
Tiny force? Reckoning? I like the sound of that. What do these things look like?
Glad you asked. We're here for live fire testing. Your combat programming will recognize enemies and auto-target your closest threat.
Live fire, eh?
Yes. Just try to aim that at them, and not me, or any friendly cells. Your weapons are medications, chemo, and antibiotics. They will not hurt holograms or nanotechnology, but they will kill cancer cells and bacteria, if used as directed. Let's begin.
So that's a cutscene that
I have activated
see
your
in
chemo
like
blaster.
A lot of games.
This
and,
is the basic
yeah,
weapon
thank you.
You'll use
and
to destroy various types of cancer.
It's meant to get you, the set the stage, and introduce some weapon. Topics. And as you see here, I can move my character around like you can in a lot of games. And fly up and down. I can spin around here, have some special moves. And he wants me to just fire my weapon right now to start getting used to
excellent.
That.
Excellent. You're now ready for some live
turn
target
just
practice.
A tiny bit. Thank you.
You have been wired with the latest targeting software, which makes target selection easy. As targets come into range, the closest and most centered target will be selected.
So we're just in a training area, targets. Part of the
I have prepared some
the body,
leukemia cells for you to
and
shoot.
In a second, when we get through shooting these leukemia cells, we will be moving out. So let me get a few of these, we can get all of these out of the way here for you, and then we'll move into the next part of the game so you can see that, and then we'll stop there. And something important to note about this game, it's definitely got high production values, and I'm sure, I don't know what the number is, but I'm sure the development figures in terms of the price was fairly high. But Hope Lab, their whole goal is to develop these games, and they actually give them away free to teens with cancer. You can download this off their website.
Perfect.
I think
you
it's called remission.org.
Just remember,
or at least you can go to Hope Lab,
and they would replicate and fight back.
You can download it, and you can actually get it free, although they ask for a donation for people if you're not a teen with cancer. So I'm going to move close and pick up some more ammo, and then I'm going to move. Let's see. And then I move into my.
Follow the hollow arrows into the next chamber.
Follow my arrows, and I go into the next chamber.
Darn it!
My apologies for your injuries, Roxy, but I need to make
and
an important
point
here.
We have to watch our health. So, like, the training part of a lot of good games, it leads you, kind of leads you at first. And then when you get beyond the training, you're actually out into the open game area and you're playing a lot of different areas, a lot of different techniques. In this game also, you communicate with the doctors. Once you're injected into the patient's body, you have to communicate with the doctors and with the patient. So it's meant to be, again, a learning process
on antibiotics.
To, you know, to understand how chemotherapy and radiation works and how to take care of yourself in terms of your health and so forth. So, again, you get the idea that it's, again, just a good general first-person shooter and one that's, I think, really well done. And what's even better are some of the results. The folks at Hope Lab did some clinical studies with the game, and for example, one of the results they found was that young people who played the game maintained higher blood levels of chemotherapy, showed higher rates of utilizing their antibiotics, and it also suggested that it helped patients adhere to their cancer therapy. So, you know, this kind of a game, this kind of activity for teens in particular has actually through tests been shown to make real difference in people's lives. Okay. So that's our examples, and what we want to do now is, let me get here. We're going to have our question and discussions. This is where we start asking each other questions, but also actually want questions from you guys too. And let me just remind you, if you do have a question, to come to the microphone in the middle, because this is being a podcast and recorded, so we want to get you on there. So this is our Q&A session, or as Mindy wanted to suggest, that it's our quibble and argument session. We want to make sure it's very interesting for you, and so if you've got contrary ideas or questions or thoughts, please let us know. So I'm just going to start out with the first one, and then we'll see where it goes from there. Okay. So my question to the panel is, if the ultimate goal is to provide a learning experience, can a serious game be a 50-50 balance of education and entertainment? Anybody? Go ahead.
I can start on that one. Actually, in my game contest, we have our rules set up so that the games are judged 70% on their entertainment value and 30% based on how well they educate these middle school students. And I feel pretty strongly about that, because as educational as a game can be, even if it's the best educational game there is, if it's not fun, they're just not going to play it. So in my opinion, you always need to skew toward the entertainment side of things, at least at first, and then kind of work the education in as you go.
Yeah, I agree too. I mean, one of the power of using games as a medium is that entertainment value, and using, you know, but, you know, of course, also you have to get that education in there. So sometimes you have to compromise a little bit on gameplay and the fun factor in order to get it in there. But if you create a game that's not fun, then yeah, you've kind of defeated the purpose of using a game to educate.
And I would say that it's a real design balance that, you know, when a designer is developing game mechanics, they're looking for the most addictively fun activity imaginable. It's going to really, you know, keep that person engaged. Their design constraints are very different, not just in time and budget, but in terms of what their outcomes are. Their outcome is pure fun. And so you have to balance that with the outcome, which is the instructional objective of, you know, most effectively and efficiently reaching your learning objectives. So I think that there's a proper placement for that within a broader curriculum, and that we do have to make some trade-offs. For example, some activity that the game designer might throw out saying, that's not really fun. It might be an activity I really have to teach. So I need to incorporate that within, you know, within maybe a larger scenario where I have some gaming activities. I have maybe some more traditional learning activities as well. And group those together in a way that satisfies all.
I agree with most of what each of you said. I will say that in my mind, if you're doing an educational game, if you define serious games as an educational game, a learning game, then ultimately there has to be that balance. And I do think that the 50-50 balance is appropriate, and I think you have to try to achieve that. It doesn't mean you'd get there right away, as you've suggested, that maybe you skew to the side of entertainment a little bit more. If you're defining a serious game as an aber game or other types of games, then obviously I think you can go a lot more to the entertainment side than the educational side. We've got a question. Please step up to the mic.
I've got an interesting question. It might be more for you, but I was especially interested to see that you're making games related to a corporate environment. And I was at the panel on alternate reality games the other day, and I was wondering if there's any bleed over in between games that educate and games that mix with reality, in that, for example, in your corporate game, you could be, I don't know, working with people, filing reports, you know, doing emails, but eventually those reports and those emails and those people become real, and eventually your, you know, the emails that you send in the game are actual real emails that you're sending to real people, and you know, so it sort of transitions you over from fake people that you're dealing with over to real people. And I'm just,
yeah.
My first response would be, I would hope that would always be true in any game, that the ultimate goal, I don't know how many were at Kathy Sierra's keynote yesterday, because she's always says really wonderful, provocative things, but that she said, you know, her goal is always to get the users together in a social form and beyond the technological constraints. And so a lot of our clients, first one that comes to mind is Wells Fargo. They've bought a lot of space in Second Life. They're using it for virtual meetings. They're using it as a learning space. They're wanting people to connect in these, you know, digital environments. And at the same time, you know, they're supplementing that with a lot of other traditional things as well.
Anybody else? Thanks. Yes, sir.
Hello there. My name is Spencer Nutting, and I am enrolled in the Texas Alternative Teaching Certificate Program here in Austin.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the plans that I have is that I'll be teaching media technology in the fall on a high school level. And at the gaming conferences here last September, I'd spoken with a number of gaming companies and individuals involved in that industry about the idea of having high school teams that would be developing a game,
yes,
that would conceivably be partnered with, say, a gaming company to actually develop a game and have it as something that's marketable and viable. My idea is that, and it doesn't seem to be approached, is that you have all these games that are geared toward children that are actually being created by adults. And it's the idea that it's the adults that are using this preconception of what's going to be fun for kids, but actually not really having the kids determining what's fun for kids.
Yeah.
So what I was, the reason why I'm asking this point is that, do you have any companies, if not, if you're not here in Austin yourself, that didn't check your bios, that you might recommend that somebody such as myself in a teaching capacity would be able to speak with to form a partnership of such?
Lauren, do you know?
Yeah, I wholeheartedly agree with the fact that, you know, adults shouldn't be the ones figuring out what's fun alone without the students who will be playing the games. That's one of the reasons I have college students developing the games for middle school students is they're not that far off from middle school. A lot of them have younger siblings and things like that. And as well, one of the biggest judging contingents each year of my contest is we get a whole room full of middle school students in to judge which are the best games. So the Hidden Agenda contest does that to a certain degree. I'm not sure, you know, this is a nonprofit foundation. I'm not sure about partnership opportunities. I don't know if anyone else knows more about that.
I've heard of some programs in California, and if you'll give me your email address, I can forward you some information about some programs in California that someone was telling me about just the other day. Much like Lauren's hidden agenda with the college students developing, it's actually middle school students developing from other middle school students, and it's really nice. You know, the best way to learn a subject is to teach a subject. So it's very effective. You know, we all know what the Web 2.0 technologies are doing, and this social constructivist environment that's now the web. I think, and the idea that the commoditizing of the digital tools and the technologies, and certainly the ease of use and the adoption rates are going to mean that we will get people, we'll get the users more involved, and hopefully very soon, in creating their own learning games. And in fact, we see what the mod community has done, in the entertainment game business.
Yeah. It's already happening that the tools for game making are getting easier. It still takes a certain amount of skill and talent, and I think there's a lower point where perhaps some younger children may not have that talent. But again, the tools are becoming easier, and in a way, it's like the reason that a lot of people can create videos and put them on, YouTube, is that it's very easy to create your own videos now. And you're going to see that more and more with game development as well. So I got to be careful, because they'll be taking away my business soon. So thank you. Please come up. Another question.
My name's Henry Hauff. I'm sorry. I'm two questions back.
No problem.
And thinking about how much entertainment value an educational game has to have, don't you have to think about it in terms of the competition? When you have a classroom, which is nothing, or a classroom lecture, which is nothing but 300 PowerPoint slides or a huge, thick, and inscrutable textbook, do you really want to blow your budget on a half an hour of Hollywood-level animation when you could use just, street-level stuff and get 10 hours or 3 days worth of instruction out of it?
Whenever you go and approaching development of an educational game, you really need to kind of look at how it's going to be used. Is it going to be in the classroom? Is it going to be instructor-led gaming as well? Or is it going to stand on its own? Do you want it to have a viral aspect and to get your message out? If you want a viral aspect, then yes. The answer to that question is yes. You want to spend a lot of time making it entertaining, so people will say, "Hey, this is fun. I want to show it to my 10 friends." But if you don't have that viral aspect, and you really do have that, we got to teach this, and we got to do it on a budget. Then, it's all kind of you establish your goals for the game prior to development, so you know exactly what to develop towards. And so I think, depending upon the situation, you could go any way with it.
Can I ask a related question to you, Ms. Davis?
Yes.
Did you bring this thing within budget? Or?
I did, yes. And it's a nonprofit family foundation, so as I was able to prove to them that a game was worth developing further, we spent the $25,000 on the prize for the college students, but we're able to spend about that again to get the games into a more finished form.
So you're working with something like $50,000?
Yes, sir.
To get those?
And
congratulations.
Thank you. And another response to your question, your one before this, was it also depends on the medium. So, of course, on $50,000, we're not going to develop, Unreal type stuff. But if you think about things like, one thing I'm looking at is cell phone games, because cell phone games don't have to be that slick in order to compete against other cell phone games. And something like Elemental, that chemistry Tetris game, I think would be great on a cell phone. And I think if kids could play it at the bus stop, then they'd be learning the periodic table a lot more quickly.
I mean, I don't know a kid in the world that would not rather sit down with your games, as simple as they are, than work through a bunch of chemistry problems in the back, yeah, the back of a
That's
chapter.
That's the hope. You know? Thank you. Yeah.
I think, too, that, you know, the way I look at it, too, especially in education, is that games are, you know, learning games may be just another tool. You know, you look at the early use of video, the early use of computers in schools, and there was a lot of questions about, you know, is that going to replace the teacher? And no, it's not. The games are just simply another tool, and if they're used poorly and if they're not done well and they're not integrated into the whole learning process, then they're going to be a wasted tool.
Hi, my name's Tom Park. I wanted to go back to the this discussion about the design being either fun or educational.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I think that one of my peeves about education is the really long feedback loop. A lot of times, like, you do your essay or you work your problems, mm-hmm, and you submit those, and then later on you get a grade back. And that feedback loop seems too long to me. And in games, I think one of the key aspects is a lot of different feedback loops. Sometimes there's a very, very fast, you know, you press a button, you shoot, you hit something.
You get a score, know. Yeah.
Yeah, mm-hmm. It's like very immediate. And in games, there's a lot of these feedback loops. When I was at Maxis working on The Sims, I noticed that Will Wright had laid out many concentric circles, yeah, of feedback loops that were designed into the game. And I can't say I've seen a lot of educational games, but I really don't see that built in. And I think, going back to the last question, I think that this this issue of having games or having educational games look like games really makes sense. I mean, it does elevate the cost, and granted, a lot of games rely on visual reward as one of the feedback, mm-hmm, rewards. But there are many other ones. You know, education is its own reward. When you get a question right, then that's gratifying. And so that you can have a very quick feedback loop in an educational game without it being, you know, you play You Don't Know Jack. You know, yeah. There's a really quick loop,
yeah,
there.
Is your question, you know, how do we achieve that balance?
Yeah, and also I was wondering if you had any examples of educational games that you've seen which do have much quicker feedback loops on, you know, there's like some simulation running in the background that will allow you to get much quicker feedback loops.
Okay.
Anybody? Oh, I guess I'll start on saying that, you know, feedback is one of the most important teaching moments you have at any given time. I mean, and it's so important in the learning cycle of, you know, I'm trying something out. Did I do it right or wrong? I get feedback. And I think you're referring to, so oftentimes you'll see these learning games that, or even just learning experience that say, good job, you got it right, go on. You know, there's nothing additive to the experience there. And that's really wasteful. That's very wasteful, because that's a really opportune teaching moment. I think, as you said, feedback should be more immediate and it can be seen. There's lots of games, I mean, that use, say, physics engines and other types of simulation devices where, you know, whatever you do in that environment, there is immediate feedback. And it's like, I like how James Paul G describes simulations for learning. You can have a sandbox, so, you know, you're just playing in the sandbox, or it can be a fish tank. And so you're controlling a set of variables. And those make for very powerful learning environments.
I'm going to, we've got about 10 minutes left, and I think about four or five people to ask questions, so I'm going to ask both you and us to ask them quickly, and we'll answer them as quickly as we can.
My name is Vanessa Davis, and I'm an educator, so I approach this from a content perspective, and mm-hmm, I'm curious if y'all could talk a little bit about what sort of tensions or lack of tensions there might be between those that are developing the games and the content specialists who have the content knowledge but also have the pedagogical knowledge, yeah, of, mm-hmm, learning objectives.
That's a good question.
Well, in for the Cisco games, we had kind of like the trinity of game design, which was the content subject matter expert, the instructional designer, and the game designer. And the goal was for those three people to get together to hash out everything, because the game designer is going to want to make it fun, the instructional designer is going to want to make it instructional, and there's conflict there. I mean, there is in that team, and but hopefully after you kind of get through that, you have a game design that accomplishes both, and it's a communication thing really inside the team. And for nobody to compromise when they don't believe in it is when you start having magic, if you can, if there is a compromise. It's having a good team that will create a good balance.
Okay. Next question.
I'm Andrea. I'm not a designer or a developer. I'm a researcher, and I research learning sciences and technologies.
Mm-hmm.
So I want to take issue with a kind of coercive rhetoric, as I see it, that creeps into these discussions, and that's the we're going to trick them into learning rhetoric, and we're going to sneak it in underneath the mashed potatoes, and they're not going to realize it was there until, oh, no, it's too late, I learned. That I don't like that. It seems coercive to me. So the way I like to think about this is more that games enable us to make things more culturally and contextually relevant to whether it's kids or people in the office or wherever it is. So given that what we're doing here is trying to make things more relevant to people, I don't understand the dichotomy that's being thrown up between education and learning. I mean, education. I got up when she. I went to sleep when she was up. So
you were partying in Austin last night, weren't you?
Can you talk a little bit about why the distinction? Why are we giving percentages like this? What does it mean to have education as opposed to entertainment?
Yeah. Is this where we get to the chair throwing? Well, we'd get there.
Yeah, okay. As the person who actually hid a game under the mashed potatoes on my HA Games website. And I did that, obviously that is all tongue-in-cheek. The fact that it's called Hidden Agenda, we're making it very obvious. So we're kind of doing the opposite of hiding the learning. We're telling all the kids that it's in there. But the way that I describe it with my contestants, the students that are building the games, is the word that I use for them is that the gameplay needs to be, or the learning needs to be baked into the gameplay. And, I think in these discussions you say it's intrinsic to the to gameplay. And what I mean, we tell them 70% entertainment and 30% learning to get them to act a certain way, which is to get them to think primarily about the gameplay, and that's really important. And then we talk to them about baking the gameplay in with the learning, because what we don't want, and what so many terrible educational games do out there today, is like, shoot the bad guy, now do a math problem, now shoot the bad guy, now do a math problem. And it's like completely disconnected between the two. And so what I'm trying to get my students to do, and what I spend a lot of time talking with them about, is this kind of baked in factor. And so I hide it in the mashed potatoes as kind of a joke to tell them not to do that. So I'm with you on this one.
Anybody else?
Go ahead.
Okay.
I'm Erin Riley. I'm the creator of Zoe's Room, and we do online educational communities for kids.
Mm-hmm.
And what I have two questions. One is on the community aspect. Have you actually seen or been able to aggregate data that the games that kids are using are actually working and that they come back again and again? Or is it just a one-time thing and then they go away and maybe do something offline and maybe relate it, but they're not actually, it's not continuous? And then the second question is we're a nonprofit, and so we're building a new game called Extreme Challenge on Health and Nutrition. And I really believe what Mindy was saying about the whole offline and online in order to educate kids. And we're building an external device called the XPED. However physically active kids are, will provide power for their online avatar. So we're looking for funding, and I'm having a hard time finding it. I'm kind of to foundations getting up like up against a dead wall, you know, and wondering if like the film model would work for things like this, for funding.
I would mention Wyville.
I know of Wyville.
Okay, so you know Wyville. I think they've been, they're out of San Antonio, and, well, I think their servers are in California, but they're out of San Antonio, so I know them. And I think they've been getting a lot of good stats about in terms of the gameplay, the return, et cetera. About the question of the money, you know, one of my chair-throwing moments is business and foundations are going to have to start contributing to these efforts because our schools are poor and it's our fault. If there's any problem with our public schools, we can look at each other and thank, you know, ourselves for that because the funding's abysmal. I could just go on and on. But we're not going to have good, serious game projects until we find the people who are going to support them and realize that our kids deserve the very best of what we're doing in corporate training or anywhere else, and that we're actually transferring innovations into our schools.
Well, do you believe in the subscription model where, you know, I mean, most if we're educators are like, oh, give it all away for free. But, they don't you have know, textbooks aren't free, so. No.
But there's an economy of scale, yeah. And, yeah. And but I know I've worked with school districts that had as much as $15 discretionary money for a child's curriculum for a year to as low as $5 per child. And that's for the whole curricula. That's not for one. That's for 1 year. So beyond what they get from the state and what they've gotten in, you know, these special purchase plans, they don't have money to spend. So there has to be some new model created to, I'm sure that's one of your problems, Lauren, is how
definitely.
Do you?
Yeah, definitely. And we're trying to figure out other ways to do it. So the textbook companies, you know, you pay for your textbooks. So maybe the textbook companies should pay for these games because they're trying to figure out. I know a lot of them come to these different serious games events.
They are.
And they're trying to get into it as well. So we're trying to work around and figure out who are the people who have the money who want to pay for these games, but there are a bunch of different ways to go about it, and I would strongly suggest anyone who's interested in this field to check out seriousgames.org or join that listserv or Games for Change, same thing, a lot of discussion on these topics on that site, like many emails a day.
Thank you. Good luck.
Thank you. It looks like I've been told we're out of time, but I would I know you have a question, so please come up afterwards and ask all of us, and I promise we'll sit here and answer just you. Okay. Wanted to mention here are some contact information for all of us and some sources if you want to learn about serious games in general. And, you know, my closing thought would be we've spent a lot of our conversation here on education and learning games, but keep in mind, too, that there's a very broad field when you talk about serious games, games for health, games for social change, political games, all that kind of stuff. And it's all part of it, and I would encourage you to learn more about it as much as you can. I want to thank my panelists and thank all of you for coming this morning. I really appreciate it. Have a good day.
Thank you.